live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel, broadcasting live and video streaming from our studios in New York City, and I welcome all of you, especially the tens of thousands of you per week, brand new, primarily younger listeners and viewers. We're here to empower people. We take on the issues that are frequently not addressed by the mainstream or alternative media: health and healing, the environment, social issues, the power of positive thought, and original investigative reporting. Today, all of those. First up, of course, we will look at the latest on health and healing. From then, my guest, Professor James Horn, we're going to talk about the dumbing down of students from high-stakes testing and the corporatization of the school system and resegregation of our schools. I will have a continuation of our original in-depth investigative white paper report on bad to the bone. Our entire pharmaceutical, medical, industrial complex needs complete overhaul. There is so much corruption. And the problem is that we hear about this and we don't do anything about it at all. So I'm making specific examples. In the last two discussions, I've talked about GlaxoSmithKline. Today, I'll be talking about Merck. And I'm sure many of the drugs I'm going to be discussing, you're probably taking or know someone who is. And then the question is, did you know that if you die and you sue or your estate sues, that's just built into the cost of doing business? So fraud is a part of the whole marketing plan, and they get away with it. And I'll be specific on that. Then a short commentary from Chris Hedges: War is Betrayal, Persistent Myths of Combat. And this is in the Boston Review. Also today, if time permits, Monsanto, a modern-day plague. And this is a call out to our president to stand up and have the courage and the decency of closing the door to the White House and to legislation that allows Monsanto to virtually do anything it wants involving its genetically engineered seeds. But I'm going to tell you about the whole history of Monsanto. This is a criminal organization that should have been dealt with a long time ago. I'm going to tell you about its criminal history. And then you decide for yourself if you want these people walking in and out of Congress and making laws. From Dr. Sandra Pellingeri from Global Research, Smart Meter Dangers. This is a more definitive report on the health hazards of wireless electromagnetic radiation exposure. Now, across the country, there's a major move to get smart meters on every home in the United States, and we're told it's good. And they spin the story that, well, they can monitor how much utility energy you're using and therefore make it less expensive. Not true. That has nothing to do with this. I'll tell you why they really are putting smart meters on, how much of a electromagnetic burst of energy you're getting per day, and why it's all dangerous all the time. As you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. Something very intriguing, but we've discussed this with several scientists in the past 20 years, and that's when we began to see that different cultures around the world use different healing techniques. For example, Gregorian chants. Have you ever been in a quiet place, played some of their music? It is so mesmerizing. It is so calming. But then listen to Mozart. Listen to Beethoven. Listen to something in an environment. The key is, are you in an environment? In a concert hall is one thing, but if you've ever sat in nature, in front of a brook or stream, or overlooked a pasture, or been in a Shakespearean wild flower garden, and suddenly you have this music, you have two different stimuli simultaneously. One you can see and smell and feel, and then one you can hear. Or how about meditation and just the repetition of a single a statement, or sound. All of these are known to improve a person's immune system. But how? Now the latest on this. Scientists have now proven that the DNA can be reprogrammed by words and frequencies. This is about what they're calling the power of hypercommunication. And this is an important study that was done in Russia. We know that the DNA is a biological internet, and we know that it works, according to the Russian scientific research, directly and indirectly, by phenomena that we have hitherto not been able to explain. In my own case, my mother was what is known as a sensitive. That meant that she had the ability to sit and talk with people and have a vibration that gave her an insight into what a person needed, and then in a very positive and reassuring way would promote the idea of do something good with your diet or your body or life. She helped so many people. Today we know that if you are sensitive to auras, the people around you, if you engage in acts of healing, if you've engaged in acts of self-healing, if you are an intuitive, this is not mumbo-jumbo. It may have been commercialized, many people to exploit it, but indeed it exists. There's evidence it's a whole new type of medicine in which DNA can be influenced and reprogrammed by words and frequencies without cutting out and replacing single genes. Now, we've been told that only 10% of our DNA is being used for building proteins. Okay. Let us not assume for a moment that nature created the other 90% for no purpose. So when the Russians went to examine what is called junk DNA, which is about 90%, they found that this junk DNA was able to actually function in a way that we had not understood. According to them, our DNA is not only responsible for the construction of our body, but also serves as data storage and in communication. The Russian linguists found that the genetic code, especially in the apparently useless 90% of our DNA, follows the same rules as all human languages. That meant that, let's say you have a rules of syntax. Syntax, by the way, means the way in which words are put together to form phrases and sentences. And then we have semantics. That is the study of the meaning in language forms. And then you have the basic rules of grammar. Well, what they discovered, which was really revolutionary, that the alkalines of our DNA follow a regular grammar, and they have a set of their own rules just like languages. So the question is then, human languages did not appear coincidentally, but are a reflection of our inherent DNA. The Russian biophysicist, molecular biologist Gargevith and his colleagues also explored the vibrational behavior of the DNA. And what they found was, quote, living chromosomes function like solitonic and holographic computers using the endogenous DNA laser radiation, end quote. What that means is they manage to modulate certain frequency patterns on a laser ray and with it influence the DNA frequency and thus the genetic information itself. Now, let us go back to Gabriel Cousins, or Norman Cousins, back in the 1970s. I met Gabriel Cousins. I was working as a research fellow in anti-aging medicine at the Institute of Applied Biology, but I also was doing vibrational medicine research at the same time. He was of the belief that if he watched comedies, even though he had a medically irreversible condition that no one could help, that it was improving. Now, he didn't understand why it was improving, but he knew it did. So he focused on the what. The what was, there was a phenomena happening. At that time, I spoke with several leading holistic humanistic psychologists, Dr. Carmi Harari, Dr. Norman Shepherd, Dr. Alan Putterman. These are people I knew personally, work with them. And they were all engaged in some very exciting work, believing, but hadn't yet proved, that anything that stimulates a positive vibration, that includes humor, laughter, love, joy, positive excitement, something that enthralls us, or what I call the creation of remarkable moments, also helps heal us. And indeed, when you look at the power of humor and why we should have humor in our lives, Norman Cousins was later found to be correct, because a whole field called psycho, meaning the psyche, neuro, the neurological system, immunology, psychoneuroimmunology, show that when you think a positive thought, your body corresponds with positive biochemistry. You think a negative thought, negative biochemistry. Now, here's what all this means, and here this how this ties together. When you put a person in a healing environment and you ask them to be silent, it forces their senses into paying attention to the environment they're in. Hence, mindful meditation. When you get a person focused on one vibration, a vibration of peaceful, harmonizing energy, like as if in early meditation where they would get people to focus by just saying Om, they go Om. Now we know through harmonics that that vibration, that simple sound, can help in the realignment of the energy of our chakras. It doesn't change the chakras. What it does, it rebalances the energy flow of the chakras. Hence, a person who's very hyper and manic can slow down. A person who is very sedate can speed up. Hence, it gives energy and vibrational energy to those who lack it, and it calms the energy and makes it more focused and pliable and doable. Now imagine how many times we've all seen the phenomena. People are simply bouncing off the walls. So what do? We medicate them. We try to suppress this. And indeed, you can chemically alter the dopamine and the serotonin receptors, and you can get a person to, in effect, become a, well, you can chemically lobotomize them. And that's what almost all of psychiatric care does today. It doesn't help anyone. It doesn't improve their condition. It merely controls it. But what if we could control not only our moods, but also the energy of a thought, so that the thought is used for healing, for problem solving, for sharing excitement and joy? And that's what they're saying, that our DNA can literally be reprogrammed. So for all those people who over the years were wondering, gee whiz, how are you able to help people with conditions that are not medically helped? Part of it has to do not with a nutritional protocol, but with a vibrational protocol. Getting a person to focus upon positive thoughts consistently, to stop negative thoughts, to say, no, I don't want that thought, to lay down new thoughts that are challenging by learning something new on a new learning curve, and to get away from just repetition of what you've already mastered, because our tendency is to always go back to what we do well, what we can succeed at, what we never have a problem with, because we've harmonized with it. But what if in the process of doing something and doing it so well we could do it in our sleep that we stop growing? Because we don't want to risk being found wrong or judged or criticized. If we had to start all over again, we lose our seniority. We lose our special place of a differential placement. We lose that unique quality of hierarchical identity. And boy, do we have a problem with that in our society. So therefore, I suggest that the moment we master something, we cease giving it the energy and master something new, always with the idea that we're challenging ourselves with new vibrational energy, hence making new remarkable moments all the time. Because look back in your life. The things that you really are pleased by, they're almost always things earlier in our life where we took some risks, we took some chances, we did something a little rebel-rousing, we stomped our feet, we yelled at the top of our lungs. We exclaimed our freedom and ourself and against injustice or for what we wanted to be. And those were remarkable moments. Now the question, when was the last time you had one? When was the last time you had a passionate, loving, remarkable moment? And then we think back. And I'm suggesting you're only going to have those backward thoughts if you can't start all over and create a new vibration by having a new idea, a new image, new thoughts, always positive, all can do, will do, and start at the bottom and without looking at anything as a mistake, look at everything as a learning experience. So as you make mistakes, you learn from them, not to repeat them again and go forward, and now you just keep mastering things. The more things you master, the more your DNA is expressing itself in a dynamic, healthy way. Hence, the more you grow intellectually and emotionally, the healthier you become. You've heard me say many times, you cannot be healthy if you're not happy. It's not possible. I've never seen it in my life, and I defy anyone to show it to me. And yet, virtually all of our energy is into getting ourselves healthy by eliminating symptoms of imbalance or disease, whether it's psychological, spiritual, or physical. But it doesn't change any of the underlying cause, and it doesn't allow our DNA that is unused to express a whole new healing dynamic. So we keep reinforcing ourselves with negative thoughts, negative behavior, gossip, malicious thoughts toward others, jealousy and envy. Whoa, do we have a lot of it listening in this particular environment where people don't like your success, so they put you down for it. Instead of looking at how they could be successful, they've grown accustomed to vibrating at a very toxic level through anger at other people. Think of people who are perpetually angry at everything. I see a lot of these as activists. I'm not opposed to what they're active against. I'm opposed to the energy they bring to it. That's why I never, you know, co-join in their energy, though I will share the energy of the movement. How many times do you feel good being around negative people, toxic people, angry people? No one does. And yet that's what the DNA is doing. The DNA is creating disease through negative thoughts, negative vibrations, negative statements, because everything that's negative you bring into yourself, unless you're able to adjust it, harmonize it, release it, surrender it, and grow from it, you become it. So remember that. Positive thoughts, positive vibration, positive DNA. Negative thoughts, negative vibration, disease. Now, to the second part of our issue. So that's brand new research. I'm very excited by that. I'm going to do more on it. In fact, I'm going to do a scientific study. I'm setting up a new lab this year on that. Now, two quick health issues. Some cyclists found that bananas have the same sports performance as Pepsi's Gatorade. This is a new study, and here's what it says. It says a new U.S. study has found that bananas were as effective as Pepsi Gatorade in providing nutritional support to trained cyclists during prolonged and intensive exercise. Great. So give up the Gatorade and start using bananas. And better still, use coconut water. And finally, the omega-3s and omega-6s show promise against ADHD. This is from the Cochrane Research Group, and it says, quote, Australian scientists report while there is data on the potential improvement in ADHD with a combined omega-3 and the omega-6 supplements. And this is good because this opens up the door for more research to be done on this. Now, I'm suggesting anyone who has an ADD or ADHD to be taking 2,000 milligrams a day of the omega-3 fatty acids. Make a big difference. Helps them tremendously. Now over to Chris Hedges' commentary. It's short, and then I'd like your feedback and comment on it, please. Our number to call in for your comments on our talkback section is 888-874-4888. This is called War is Betrayal, Persistent Myths of Combat, from Boston Review by Chris Hedges. We condition the poor and the working class to go to war. We promise them honor, status, glory, and adventure. We promise boys they will become men. We hold these promises up against the dead-end jobs of small-town life. the financial dislocations, credit card debt, bad marriages, lack of health insurance, and dread of unemployment. The military is the call of the sirens, the enticement that has for generations seduced young American working in fast food restaurants or behind the counters of Walmarts to fight and die for war profiteers and elites. The poor embrace the military because every day cul-de-sacs in their lives breaks their spirit and their dignity. Pick up Eric Marie Remarque's All Quiet on the Western Front, or James Jones's From Here to Eternity, or read the Iliad. The allure of combat is a trap, a ploy, an old dirty game of deception in which the powerful, who do not go to war, promise a mirage to those who do. I saw this in my own family. At the age of 10, I was given a scholarship to a top New England boarding school. I spent my adolescence in the schizophrenic embrace of the wealthy, on the playing fields and in the dorms and classrooms that conditioned boys and girls for privilege, and came back to my working-class relations in the depressed form of mill towns in Maine. I came back a different person. I traveled between two universities, one where everyone got a chance after chance after chance, where connections and money and influence almost guaranteed that you would not fail, the other where no one ever got a second try. I learned at an early age that when the poor fall, no one picks them up. When the rich stumble and trip, they do so to the top. Those I knew in prep school did not seek out military service and were not sought by it. But in the impoverished enclaves of central Maine, where I had relatives living in trailers, nearly everyone was a veteran. My grandfather, my uncles, my cousins, my second cousins, they were all in the military. Some of them, including my Uncle Morris, who fought in the infantry in the South Pacific during World War II, were destroyed by the war. Uncle Morris drank himself to death in his trailer. He sold the hunting rifle my grandfather had given him to buy booze. He was not alone. After World War II, thousands of families struggled with broken men who, because they could never read the approved lines from the patriotic script, had been discarded. They were not trotted out for Red, White, and Blue Love Fest on the 4th of July or Veterans Days. The myth of war held fast, despite the deep bitterness of my grandmother, who acidly denounced what war had done to her only son and others like her. The myth held because it was all the soldiers and their families had, even those who knew it to be a lie, and I think most did, were loath to give up the fleeting moments of recognition, the only times in their lives they were told they were worth something. Any story of war, any story, is the story of elites preying on the weak, the gullible, the marginal, the poor. I do not know a single member of my graduating prep class who went into the military. You could not say that about the high school class that graduated the same year in Mechanic Falls, Maine. Those who return to speak the truth of war are contemporary prophets. They struggle in a culture awash in lies to tell what few have the fortitude to digest. The words these prophets speak are painful. As a nation, we prefer to listen to those who speak from the patriotic script. We prefer to hear ourselves exalted. If veterans speak of terrible wounds, visible and invisible, of lies told to them to kill, of evil committed in our name, we fill our ears with wax. Not our boys, not our girls, we say, not them, bred in our homes, endowed with our goodness and decency, for it is too easy for them to murder. What about us? Is it simpler, more comfortable not to hear, to wish only that they could calm down, be reasonable, get some help, and go away? We brand our prophets as madmen. We cast them into the desert. This is why so many veterans are estranged and enraged. This is why so many succumb to suicide and addictions. Not long ago, I received a text message from a Marine named Goodwell, who had worked with the mortuary affairs after trying to commit suicide. Quote, I got $2,000 in the bank, the message read. Let's meet in New York City and go out with a bang. War comes wrapped in a patriotic slogan. calls for sacrifice, honor, and heroism, and promises of glory. It comes wrapped in the claims of divine providence. It is what a grateful nation asks of its children. It is what is right and just. It is waged to make the nation and the world a better place, to cleanse evil. War is touted as the ultimate test of manhood, where the young can find out what they have been and what they are made of. From a distance, it seems noble. It gives us comrades and power and a chance to play a big part, or a bit part, in the great drama of history. It promises to give us identities as warriors, patriots, as long as we go along with the myths. The one the war makers need to wage wars, and the defense contractors need to increase their profits. But up close, war is a soulless void. War is about barbarity, perversion, and pain. Human decency and tenderness are crushed, and people become objects to kill. The noise, the stench, the fear, the scenes of eviscerated bodies and bloated corpses, the cries of the wounded, all combine to spin those in combat into another universe. In this moral void, naivety blessed by secular and religious institutions at home, the hypocrisy of our social conventions, our strict adherence to moral precepts, becomes stark. War, for all of its honor, we are told, is also all of its horror. And it is the power to strip away the trivial and the banal, the empty chatter and the foolish obsessions that fill our days. It might let us, although, see for a moment the sanity of something. Chris Hedges. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to go to our guest in just a second, but just a short commentary on an in-depth original investigative report that I started 2 days ago. I'll give you a few pages. We'll go to our guest and then on to our calls. In my last discussion, I talked about how individuals from Jeffrey Skilling, president of Enron, is now serving a 24-year prison sentence, and others at Enron are serving time. But what about the people in all the pharmaceutical industries whose drugs they knowingly created with the evidence presented at trial that show that, yes, it was going to kill people, and it did, as many as 60,000 with Vioxx alone? Not a single person was charged with a criminal process, but rather misdemeanors. And they paid billions of dollars, $3 billion in the case of GlaxoSmithKline. I'm going to give another example, Merck. Merck is sharing the limelight with GlaxoSmithKline, the U.S.-based pharmaceutical company responsible for producing the lion's share of vaccines required for school attendance. In the same week that the Governor Haley of South Carolina vetoed Merck's Gardasil for 7th graders, the same week that a study was published asserting that the Gardasil vaccine is not relevant to the needs of women in India, and came the biggest bombshell yet for Merck regarding one of their other vaccines. Two former Merck virologists have filed suit against Merck for falsifying test data and for knowingly selling a mumps vaccine that they knew was not effective against the mumps virus. They charge the scientists working for Merck as whistleblowers now that for more than a decade, Merck has maintained an ongoing scheme to sell the U.S. government a mumps vaccine that is, quote, mislabeled, misbranded, adulterated, and falsely certified as having efficacy rate that is significantly higher than it actually is, end quote. This news is so devastating it can't be ignored, even by those who sanctify the vaccine makers and give the damage caused by their products a free pass. There have been many mumps outbreaks in recent years, and in every case, blame is cast on parents who decline vaccines for their children, despite the fact that examination of the actual scientific data and facts always reveals that these outbreaks are ongoing and occurring in the vaccinated children, not the unvaccinated one. And here is the evidence that the fix was in. Since 1999, 13 years, Merck has known that its mumps vaccine fails the standard test of efficacy. Merck's strain of mumps used in all their vaccines was originally created in 1967 by the famed virologist Dr. Maurice Hilleman, who took a culture sample from his own mumps-infected daughter, Gerald Lynn, and developed the Gerald Lynn strain. While initially a single vaccine, in 1971, the mumps vaccine had been packaged together with measles and rubella to form the MMR vaccine. At the same time, Merck was given exclusive marketing rights to the MMR by the FDA, and there is currently no other option in the U.S. to obtain a vaccine for measles, mumps, and rubella aside from Merck's MMR or its successor, MMR2, or ProQuad. Merck annually sells about 7.6 million doses of the MMR2, for which it derives hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. The largest purchaser of vaccine in the United States, which buys 4 million doses annually, is the United States government. The problem with the current mumps vaccine, and one has to imagine that other vaccines have this issue as well, is that the strain of mumps in use was created decades ago and has lost much of its efficacy since then. To manufacture vaccines, it is necessary to passage a virus through animals and cells cultures repeatedly, and quite simply, the Gerald Lynn viral strain has grown weaker and possibly has mutated over the many years it has been in use. By 1999, it was no longer able to pass muster. 32 years after its original infected Hilleman's daughter, and since we are now 13 years further down the road since this problem was discovered, the vaccine can only have gotten weaker in the intervening time. Were it not for the fact that in late 1990s, Merck sought to develop a new MMR vaccine, both in the United States and Europe, which would include the chickenpox, which is the ProQuad, the company would not have had to initiate new efficacy testing, and the weakness of the mumps vaccine would likely not have come to light. But once Merck opened up its Pandora's box, it had to find a way to prove that the CDC that the MMR was 95% effective for all three of its components, meaning measles, mumps, and rubella, or risk losing its monopoly on the vaccine, which earns about $700 million a year for the company. This meant that Merck either had to go back to the drawing board or improve the vaccine, or it had to lie. The complaint filed against Merck by two whistleblowers, Dr. Stephen Crawling and Dr. Joan Walensky, virologists working on the mumps strain of the MMR vaccine when the new testing commenced, is 55 pages long and exhaustive in its detail. It describes a tale of intrigue and subterfuge as Merck discovered through testing that its mumps vaccine was far from 95% efficacy rate it originally demonstrated back in the 1960s. Even the name of the testing program, Protocol 007, smacks of obfuscation. The method Merck devised to demonstrate the efficacy of the mumps portion of the MMR vaccine was the plaque reduction neutralization, or PRN, assay, in which blood samples are taken from children before they receive the mumps vaccine, then afterwards. Both pre- and post-samples were then incubated with the mumps virus and placed on cell sheets to observe whether plaques formed, which would indicate virus replication, meaning no immunity to the mumps virus. Ideally, if the mumps vaccine worked effectively, there would be a plaque formation in the pre-sample, indicating that blood from an unvaccinated child is not able to neutralize the virus, but little plaque formation in the post-sample, because the vaccinated blood should neutralize the virus effectively. The PRN assay simply compares the numbers of plaques in the pre- and post-samples to determine if vaccination caused the child to develop a sufficient number of antibodies to neutralize the virus. From the outset, Merck's test deviated from what would have been the gold standard by not using the wild-type virus that would have occurred naturally in communities, but instead using a laboratory-concocted Gerald Lynn strain of the virus used to make the mumps vaccines. And since the vaccine specifically targeted this particular mumps strain, favorable test results should have been a slam dunk. They should have easily been able to demonstrate efficacy. What Merck found, however, was that the post-samples fell far short of a 95% reduction in plaque formation, even with this testing advantage. Senior investigator David Krall admitted to Crawling that the efficacy of the mumps vaccine had declined over time because the constant passage of virus to make more vaccines had degraded the product. What the company did next was devise an exhaustive, enhanced version of the assay, meaning they cooked it up. Tomorrow I will go into depth on this more, but that's just to give you an idea. The next time you're told, take your vaccines, they're safe and effective, you have every right to say, how do I know they're safe and effective? Well, we tested them. Did you have independent scientists test them? And by what standard? Let us see the protocols. All that is hidden. All that is considered proprietary. And yet, how many people have had adverse reactions to the MMR vaccine? How many children have been injured or died? So until such time that we have honesty in science, especially proprietary science, we will have whistleblowers coming forward who had the courage to tell the truth. We wouldn't know about these lies if it weren't for these whistleblowers. And yet, instead of honoring the whistleblowers, the government under this administration is attacking whistleblowers. And we will deal with that on tomorrow's show. I'm Gary Nall. Now to our guest who is standing by. Professor James Horn is an associate professor in the doctoral of education program at the Department of Education Leadership at Cambridge College, Massachusetts. He has 30 years' experience as a K-12 educator and a school administrator. He comments and blogs on educational matters at School Matters and has published widely on social justice issues in education. He is an outspoken opponent of corporate education reform and high-stakes testing models, which we'll discuss in more detail. His website is schoolmatters.info. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks for having me on.
I'd like to go through three issues and just have you take each one in turn and tell us your perspective on them, all right?
Okay.
I'm very concerned that when you and I were growing up, as all of our generation of baby boomers, if we did not do our homework, if we could not understand something, and if we could not get the test right, we were given the grade that we deserved or we were held back. That has all changed. I cannot remember ever being pre-tested before a test and given tutoring and having people hired at $100 an hour to help me pass any test. I don't know that that ever happened growing up, nor did it ever happen when I went back and spoke with teachers. There was the teaching in the class, there was doing your homework, and then there were tests. And we were given that opportunity to grow and learn. Today, that has changed. I'd like for you to take us on how the older forms of educational standards and curriculum and teaching and methodology has been privatized, corporatized, and what it means for the system and the students. Separately, we now have one of the most illiterate groups of young people in America's history who've gone through our educational process, either high school or high school and college. And we're confused by that. How could we be having so many tests with people getting so many grades after so much coaching, counseling, and almost doing the tests for them and still have such illiteracy rates? And lastly, why is it that both the Obama administration and the Bush administration felt that sponsoring and supporting No Child Left Behind and the charter schools and the privatization of school would not end up, in the end, dumbing down children or segregating children and even making things worse for many children? Could you address these three separate issues, please?
Well, those are some big issues that cover a lot of territory. First, let me address the testing issue. Some people believe that the problem is really not testing, but the problem is the kind of high-stakes testing, the kind of high-stakes testing that we have today, high-stakes standardized testing, which has really taken over much of what we do in schools for the last 25 years, especially since 2000 with No Child Left Behind, with its testing demands and its sanctions attached to it. So the students who are getting those $100 an hour tutors are not the children in the schools that are supposedly failing. The testing, as Alfie Cohn has pointed out, the testing is a better indicator of how big the houses are in the neighborhood as far as the scores are concerned. Rather than measuring how much a child knows, tests really measure wealth and income. So the better your school stands socioeconomically, the better the test scores reflect that fact. And this is true for whether we're talking about the SAT test or whether we're talking about the state tests that are given for No Child Left Behind. So this kind of testing is detrimental to the kind of schools that many of us grew up with. And learning has been crammed into a smaller and smaller box as curriculum shrinks to reflect what is tested. And of course, the teacher is being under the gun to raise test scores, then they teach what is on the test. So we have in urban schools anyway, we have a test, what I do call test preparation factories, where out in the leafy suburbs and the middle class suburbs where children are doing fine and are not failing the test, the curriculums out there continue to be rich and doing the interesting things that most of us who grew up in the 60s and the 70s remember a school being like. But so we have a curriculum caste system that has emerged as a result of high stakes testing, so that poor students who do poorly on the test are given a sort of a total compliance, crammed down test preparation curriculum, and the middle class children are receiving quite a different education.
All right, that's so, one area. But that's grossly unfair because it means that you're creating a caste system, an educational caste system in the United States, much like they have in India.
Yes, I think that is clearly indicated in terms of what's happened over the past decade. And with the advent of the charter schools, which is another part of the question that you asked, charter schools are making the situation even worse because charter schools have been shown by research by the Civil Rights Project at UCLA and by Gary Miron at Western Michigan in a separate study to have really segregative effects, so that even in intensely segregated urban areas, with the advent of charter schools, we find what we can call apartheid schools, where the schools are entirely black or black and Hispanic, which is exactly the result that we wouldn't expect, you know, 60 years after Brown versus Board of Education. But this is the fact that we're facing. And not only are these charter schools largely segregated in urban areas, but they are also run by nonprofit or for-profit corporations, depending on the type of charter school they are. So it is a deterioration of the public school system, because now we have public school systems that are losing huge sums of money, as in the very financially stressed Philadelphia school system at this time, losing millions and millions of dollars that are going to charter school operators because the schools have been deemed failures, and therefore the solution that has been offered is to privatize them and turn them into charter schools.
What do you believe is necessary now to really turn our educational system around, to have the quality education that we once had?
Well, as I and a number of my colleagues have pointed out for the last number of years, the problem is really poverty. Our children who are middle-class children who will go to public schools, and, of course, middle-class children who go to the best private schools, like the president's children who go to Sidwell, a private school in near D.C., those children are doing fine in terms of the performance on international tests. They're doing just great. Now, there's a ExxonMobil commercial that's on TV right now that talks about American children being 25th in math and 17th in science, and is focusing on pressure on teachers to do a better job. So that is their focus. But what the commercial doesn't point out is that we are 34th, and the United States is 34th out of 35 developed nations in terms of poverty. We're next to the bottom in terms of poverty. Our poverty rate in the United States is 23% among children. So the top two quintiles, the top 40%, even the top 60%, on international tests are doing great. The top quintile, the top 20% of our kids are doing better than any other group in the world. But it's the large percentage of poverty, impoverished children, that brings our test scores and our academic achievement down. So until we do something about poverty, we really can't do anything about educational achievement. Jean Anion, who teaches at, I believe she's at City College, and has written widely on this subject of looking at education policy as a bigger issue than just what happens inside the school. Jean says that thinking that we can improve the schools without improving the communities around the schools is like trying to clean the air on one side of a screen door. It's just an impossible task because the effects of poverty in the community are felt throughout the school and influence everything that happens in the school.
I appreciate these insights. And, of course, how to help the people who are impoverished is the key. And I don't believe the bureaucracies, which frequently are administratively top-heavy and squander most of the actual resources, are the answer. I believe that putting together community-based nonprofit or charitable groups to work within each community to, I believe we have to de-ghettoize America. And if we took the money away from the military-industrial complex, which it does not need, we don't need $1.4 trillion spent on that each year, and the medical-industrial complex, of which is $3 trillion, of which at least half is completely profit for the for-profit corporations and insurance, drugs, and hospitals, and we reallocated that to rebuilding the infrastructure of our cities and the social fabric of our cities, I believe that we could see an enormous renaissance in the United States, but that takes a different mindset, and that's just not politically doable in the current scheme of things. And I don't see it changing unless we get new, more progressive leaders in positions of power. Final thoughts,
well,
Jim?
I think that's a terrific insight. And the last piece I would add to this is that in terms of progressives, I think that the progressive movement has to be focused once more upon integration of our society, not only in schools but in our communities. We know the effects of socioeconomic integration and how it raises achievement. We know the value of social capital, going all the way back to the research from James Coleman in the 1960s. This is a reality, and it has been done around the country, socioeconomic integration, and it works. It's probably the best bang for the buck in terms of raising achievement, and it does what is good for the community, for our communities too, by creating more diversity, which is a strength in every situation.
I was reading the latest statistics that if we wanted to really help the inner America and the suburban ghettoization program, it would cost about $45 billion. Well, the war on drugs costs us over $50 billion each year, and that's the stupidest war we've ever fought. So I think that...
And we're not even winning it.
No, well, we can't. It's not winnable. So,
no, it's not.
But we could do a great deal of good if we reappropriated and reapplied those funds elsewhere. Jim, thank you for your good work. I appreciate you being on with us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Professor,
have a good day.
Professor James Horn, and his website is schoolsmatter.info. Let me also mention before we go to our next guest here that I'm still waiting for the invitation to come to Camden to rebuild an entire block, putting in everything that's necessary to show how to de-ghettoize a community using only people from the community. I'll pay for it out of my own pocket, but I don't want the bureaucrats and the people who do nothing but cause problems in our lives to interfere in the process. Now, since Camden's the poorest, most crime-ridden city per capita in the United States, you know, there is no downside to try to help people get back up on their feet. Nothing's being done otherwise. I'll wait that a call. Let's go over. My other guest is standing by. He was on yesterday briefly. We're having him back briefly here for a few moments. He is Steve Kahn, And nice to have you back with us today, Steve.
Thank you so much, Gary. Great to be here.
A few things that have happened. Steve is one of the chief attorneys in the United States representing whistleblowers and a whistleblowers foundation, and has a program following mine in about 8 minutes. But here's what's important. Let me give you the broad overview. For decades, the FDA has attacked virtually everything that is done in a positive way with natural healing. It has supported the Quackbusters, and they in turn are supported by Wikipedia and Google. And so if you're Joanne Whitaker, if you're Mike Adams, if you're anyone doing good work as a holistic physician, if you're doing good work and healing, they're going to attack you. And because they've used the same modus operandi for decades, and never does the media stop, like the New York Times, which used the Quackbusters as their so-called experts, and it in case after case, adjudicated, the Quackbusters not only lose, but in the actual court documents, they're shown to be not expert. You know, they have no expertise in the health at issue at all. And then you look at their financing, you look at they're just mouthpieces for the pharmaceutical industry. So what you have is you have an enormous pharmaceutical industry, the most powerful industry in America, and they control the medical journals, the curriculum in medical schools, they control accreditation, they control the AMA, they in turn control the state medical boards. So you don't practice their medicine, you're in trouble. If you cure a patient but not using their techniques, you're in trouble. You bring out anything that actually works, and if it's not controlled by a patent, you're in trouble. And the FDA has always been the attack dog. Well, now the FDA has taken on the rules of determining do we need supplements or not. They don't want us to take supplements. They want to ban all supplements. They don't want organic produce. They want genetically engineered produce. In fact, they've got Michael Taylor, former lawyer, top lawyer for Monsanto, who heads the food safety division of the FDA. And so when you look at the FDA, it has been formidable. So when we try to get a story out against dangerous vaccines that I just talked about today, fraudulent vaccines, killing people with Vioxx, knowing that it was a dangerous drug and would kill people, instead of the Justice Department coming in and doing what it should do and bring criminal indictments against them with jail sentences, if found guilty, it's a misdemeanor. They paid $7.5 billion in fines just GlaxoSmithKline alone. Merck has paid over $6 billion, and they get misdemeanor fines based upon criminal penalties. No one's reputation is adversely affected. No one goes to jail. Everything continues as a cost of doing business, the same for Wall Street firms, and supporting them, protecting them, protecting the entire medical industrial complex is the FDA. So I did this documentary called The War on Health, and it's gone viral. Just even this morning, I was just told that we had 11.2 million visits today on our network, and about 11 million people have taken a look at Gary Null TV to see what's going on with this film. In any case, in the film, we actually expose why the FDA should be completely deconstructed, totally, why the former people and current people should be put in on trial for crimes against humanity, why, in effect, it's operating like a criminal organization, why it's got whistleblowers and what these whistleblowers are saying. And no one, not even the New York Times, is saying, well, hold on, what is this whistleblower saying? What actually is the what did they see and know that was against our well-being as a society? No one's asking these questions. Well, hey, we did it. It's there. And now they've been caught. Finally, the FDA was caught red-handed, taking emails, 80,000 private emails between whistleblowers, researchers, journalists, lawyers, and looking through them with a private contractor to see what kind of damage could be likely to happen and how they could harass, intimidate, get one of their private black operators on the case. And that's where we're at now. I believe that this is the current Watergate. And I believe we're at the very beginning. I believe that we're going to see that none of this could have happened without the commissioner of the FDA and the higher-ups knowing it. And because the FDA falls under the guidance and the supervision of the Health and Human Services, and that's a cabinet position, that would have been discussed by people within the cabinet, which meant it could go clear to the President of the United States. So I'm asking today, for federal prosecution investigation into crimes against humanity based upon illegalities, and I want to see this go clear to the White House, wherever it leads. And unlike before, well, let's forgive every crime committed, no matter how horrendous in the past. No. You commit a crime, do the time. I'd like to see everyone in Washington has committed a crime. You would have empty streets. You could film a film there and not see anyone walking the sidewalks if you put every criminal in Washington in prison. So that's where I'm at. Now, tell me where you stand on this, and if I'm off base here, correct me. I'm happy to be corrected any time I step over a line. Steve?
Well, thank you, Gary. And I'd like to say that, you know, we are also calling for major investigations and accountability on what we've discovered. And we have an action alert at whistleblowersradio.org, and we really, really need people to join in and start putting the pressure on. Your analogy to Watergate is spot on. First, but just so everyone knows, the listeners, when the Watergate people were breaking into the Watergate and stealing documents, we're able to do pretty much the same thing now. We have uncovered the trove of raw data related to an illegal spying campaign conducted by FDA against their own scientists and doctors who were whistleblowers. It's never before happened. A massive amount of documents that give us a window in. Like Watergate, they have an electronic version of the enemies list, a list of 21 doctors, scientists, journalists, a congressman, and members of congressional staff whom they identified as working together to, quote, defame, end quote, the FDA. What that meant was they were working together to file complaints documenting major patient safety issues that the FDA was either covering up or going along with industry to cause. So they have an enemies list. Then they were breaking into the private conversations of the whistleblowers and tracking them to who else they were talking to. They went into their private Gmails that were passcode protected. The evidence now shows that whatever spyware they had allowed them to migrate from a government laptop into privately owned computer equipment. They were doing it at people's homes. So this monitoring, which was illegal, is now coming to light, and it's clear that it targeted scientists and doctors who were raising major public health and safety issues concerning misconduct at FDA. That's why it's so important for the public now to weigh in on this. We need public support. We need to mobilize. We need to have letters to senators, congressmen, Obama, to the Justice Department, etc., to know that the public is concerned both about the safety issues the whistleblowers were exposing and illegal, warrantless surveillance of whistleblowers.
This is terrific. We're going to keep on this because I believe that behind all this, we're going to uncover in time, in discovery and depositions, we will discover that the pharmaceutical industry had its dirty hands all over this because historically they're the ones who get these quackbusters and others. Because if you, Steve, were to have anything on you on Wikipedia and you tried to change it, to correct it, instantly it would be corrected back. So they control, the pharmaceutical industry controls the little septic tank of Wikipedia, and we're doing an expose on them. But this time they've gotten caught.
I want to add to that, Gary, that we now know through documentation that General Electric was pushed for the first round of surveillance. And we know that other companies would clearly be involved because it was their products that the whistleblowers were contesting. There also seems to be involvement by hedge funds and people who would invest money into getting a device approved, have millions or billions at stake in that approval process, and then assert pressure. So we're beginning to open that up. And I say we do have a letter from General Electric's attorneys to the managers at FDA urging that they go after these scientists.
Well, that is a crime. That is a felony. We intend to pursue this. We want you to pursue it. We're getting behind you, Steve, because you're the lawyer. You're the one who's brought the most lawsuits. You've won the most lawsuits on the behalf of whistleblowers. You're not afraid, like Jonathan Eamore. Do you know Jonathan?
I do not.
Okay, he is in the film War on Health, and he has won 7 out of 7 cases against the FDA. He's tough, and I know you're tough, so we're going to be behind you on this. And by the way, here's two things that I just came up with because we're starting a major investigation on our own. Now, let's say this administration says, well, we didn't know any of this. Sorry. Fox News, January 2009, FDA scientists complained to Obama of, quote, corruption. Let me quote this. In an unusually blunt letter, a group of federal scientists complained to the Obama transition team of widespread managerial misconduct in the Division of the Food and Drug Administration. Quote, the purpose of this letter is to inform you that the scientific review process for medical devices at the FDA has been corrupted and distorted by current FDA managers, thereby placing the American public at risk, end quote. Now, that went directly to President, then Obama. So on the one hand, they warned Obama. They warned him and Ron Emanuel and his whole cabinet. Everyone in the White House knew there was corruption at the FDA. They did nothing to stop it. So that's something that's important you have, yeah. Steve.
And Gary, let me just now just add to that. And everything you said is absolutely accurate, is these are the same scientists who signed that letter, who were then the subject of the targeted surveillance. There's a direct connection. When initially 9 doctors and scientists, many with international reputations, the leaders in their fields, they stepped forward and raised these type of allegations against the FDA, and they have materials and all of the evidence to prove it, you can see how scared those managers were. So instead of addressing any of the issues, they initiated one of the most vicious, retaliatory campaigns I have seen in 30 years of representing whistleblowers, because they stole all of their private information. They got into their passcodes. They clearly were looking for embarrassing documents because they were getting screenshots where they, like if you put a photo up on your computer but you didn't save it, they'd capture that photo. So they wanted to see if like any of these whistleblowers had embarrassing images on their computers, anything embarrassing. So when you have a government agency using all of the power of the government and those investigatory resources to try to find dirt on people, to blackmail them, to embarrass them, to fire them. They made 2 criminal referrals, both fell flat on their face. But when they engage in this type of retaliatory conduct over a prolonged period of time, I know one thing. They were afraid of those whistleblowers. They wanted to make sure no one else in the FDA would ever do what these 9 scientists and doctors did. They wanted to create a chilling effect. And the way they did it was they went way over the top in an investigation and retaliatory actions. Remember, 5 were fired, none of them based upon any misconduct. They never proved any leaks of information. But it was such a vicious campaign designed to scare the employees of FDA into silence. And it's we're going to fight as absolutely hard as we can to turn this around. But as I say, I can't, we need public support.
Steve, give us your website so this audience can get on board to help.
Sure. It's whistleblowers.org. Or you can also go to whistleblowersradio.org, and that's where we're going to have our show that's following yours, Gary, Honesty Without Fear, where we'll continue this dialogue.
Okay, we're going to let you get into your show. I can stay for a few moments, and then I got to go up and help WBI raise some money. So you're listening to Steve Kahn. We're going to say goodbye for now, and please stay with us because the Whistleblower Hour is starting right now on the Progressive Radio Network.